Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Now, I need you all for a project. James Jeffries, a friend of Robert's, is sponsoring Dumpty Dum. He is very nearly as clever as Robert and, actually, slightly more creative. He builds prototypes for the web and does some amazing things with data for arts and culture. In fact, I may ask him to work on the Village website if I can loosen Jennifer's grip on the thing. He's worked with all the best people, you know. The BBC Research and Development team, creating interactive story explorers for Homefront and Peaky Blinders. For the London Philharmonic Orchestra, creating a prototype of a searchable archive of their historic performances. Once, he even built some tweeting receipt printers for a Bill Drummond exhibition. Now, that's the kind of innovation we need for the Village show. So if you'd like to talk to him about your project idea, you could get in touch with him at Robert, what's his email address? James@shedcode.co.uk. That's James@shedcode.co.uk. Or you could have a browse of his website, shedcode.co.uk. Do tell him I was looking for him if you see him, won't you? I want him to design me a digital resurgence stone.
Hello, everybody at Dumpty Dum. This is Auntie Jean here at the London meetup of Dumpty Dum. We've had a lovely time, and even though Derek in the back bedroom, Royford and Lucy have had to go, the rest of us are going to sing a Dumpty Dum. So, are we ready, ladies?
Yeah. We are.
One, two, three.
Dumpty 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 Dum, Dumpty Dumpty Da Dum, Dumpty 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 Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dumpty Diddly Dumpty Diddly Dum. Dumpty 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 Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dum.
All right, yeah. So let's get cracking, and you never know, we might even mention the Archers in our conversation at some point.
You never know.
All right.
You never know.
Cool. All right. This is Dumpty Dum, the show about the reality ducky drama that is centred on Ambridge in the heart of the Midlands. I'm the half-eaten mince pie who is Royfield Brown, and with me I have the land-owning mummy's boy and foe of Toby Fairbrother, who is?
David Archer, a.k.a. Tim Bentinck.
I forgot to queue up there, Mr. B. I do apologise. Today's rendition of the Archers theme tune was brought to you by Auntie Jean and the Dumpty Dum Xmas Posse. To bring in the new year, we are going to take a look back at some of the storylines in Ambridge over the years that have featured Brookfield and David Archer and his family. But first, before we dive into that, Mr. B, how's your Christmas been?
It's been fantastic. It's been great. We've amongst other interesting presents, I gave my son Will the PlayStation VR. Helmet. So we've been flying X-wing fighters, which in virtual reality, which I have to say is one of the most extraordinary experiences you could ever possibly imagine.
Wow.
Yeah, it really is. And also the other thing we've got is a thing called an Amazon an Alexa Dot, which is, I don't know if you've come across it, it basically is voice commands. So you just walk into the room and you say, you say, Alexa, play some sweet reggae music. And she goes, okay. And I go, comes out. It's just the coolest thing.
Oh, wowza.
So we're very 21st century here this Christmas. It's been quite a techie Christmas.
You know what? You're somewhat queuing me up for my last question. So I'm going to do the last question first. Now,
okay.
Right. So at the turn of the millennium,
yeah.
When everyone was kind of partying like it's 1999 and all of that, David and Ruth were planning to move away and farm in France, as your dad, Phil, wouldn't let you farm the way that you wanted. Can you remember much about that storyline?
You set me up by giving me some notes for this, and when I read that, I went, I simply cannot remember the idea of us ever wanting to move to France. I mean, there was this, you know, are we going to move north up to Hadley Hoch? But do you know what? I simply cannot remember moving to France. It can't have been a very long storyline, was it? Was it just a sort of passing thought?
It was. I can't remember exactly the reason why, but there was a little bit of tension between you and an older archer running for a few months beforehand. And you, right. in a fit of pique, said, you know what, Dad, if I can't have things my own way, we're going to go and farm in France. But I suppose that's the first time that I kind of realised, looking back at the various storylines, that... That basically January the 1st obviously is the birthday of the archers, but is mm-hmm. used by the writers to signal the end of a storyline or some kind of big dramatic shift. So how important do you think that is actually for us to remember that in that kind of subtle way?
Well, it's very clever of you to point that out, and I hadn't really kind of put two and two together in that way. I think I'm not sure that it's done consciously. I think perhaps it's sort of an unconscious thing. Certainly, just at the moment, the Robin Helen story is you know coming to its close, and whether or not I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know what they've got planned, but whether or not that's going to continue to bubble or not, it's certainly not taking centre stage anymore. We had, as you know, I mean. Because you know we record 5 weeks ahead, so we have this weird thing where we have our Christmas and we have our New Year 5 weeks before everybody else, and then we have our real one. So you know, we recorded that rather torturous scene of Christmas with Toby there, which was I thought terrifically well written and very interesting. And therefore, you know, then the new year will bring, you know, new storylines and new things. And I think probably judging from the sense of listening to, you know, to friends who listen to the Archers and to other people and to kind of feedback, that there is a feeling that wonderful as the Robin Helen story was, which it was, you know, it's quite extraordinary and did what the Archers needs to do, which is every now and again to bring in the younger listener, because otherwise, you know, it dies with a generation. And that's always a good thing. My worry is slightly, I'm not sure if I said this on the last time when we were chatting with Terry, slightly that people, the new listener, will think that that's what it's always like, you know, that it's always about kind of domestic abuse and those kind of storylines, and that actually, you know, the Archers that we all know, the older listener and the more traditional, the long-term listener, knows that it isn't always like that, and it is more gentle, and, you know, it tends to be more farming-centric and things, and whether or not people are going to be, the new listener might go, God, I didn't realise it was all like this. So I'm slightly
so you're
concerned,
trying to say that people might be put off by talk of Herefords?
Yeah, you never know. But I mean, if they are, then, you know, then there'll be a drop off. But on the other hand, you might get people who are interested in domestic abuse who suddenly get turned on by farming, you know, so that'll be a plus. So I mean, from my point of view, just because we, you know, we only get paid per episode, it's a bit of a fallow year for David and Ruth. We haven't had that much, but you know, we'll pop back up, I'm sure, and we'll be back. I mean, apart from anything else, we've got the great storyline about the ongoing thing about the generational thing, you know, between that I had between myself and you know, but David had between you know, with his dad. And farming and the conflict between the ideas about farming, you know, looking at that thing about France, you know, all of that has been my life as being David. I've had this sort of conflict with Dad about generational things, bringing in new ideas. And that's precisely, it's wonderful now, you know, to find that Pip is we're having the same conversations, you know, kind of 20 years later, the other way around. And that David's, you know, being, as it were, slightly more traditional and slightly more stick in the mud, and she's coming up with the new ideas. But I think he's more open in a way to new ideas because he was like that himself. And, you know, to be fair, I mean, his father was, Phil was like that with his own dad. He was always bringing in new ideas. So this is a, this is an ongoing theme that each generation kind of wants to change things and bring in new ideas and bring things up to date and you know, bring the farm into the 21st century, you know, kicking and screaming. But also how to survive, because the reality for farmers is, you know, is terribly, terribly dire. I mean, the profit margins are tiny, particularly with dairy farmers. Mm-hmm. How do you survive? And these are stories that are being put up in the programme, which are real. They're not fiction. You know, that's what's so great about the programme, is that you ally great drama with the reality of life for farmers, which, you know, it was ever thus, and long may it continue.
Absolutely. Now, it's kind of interesting that you talked about the tension with you and Phil, and obviously the generational tension between you and Pip. But there has been another kind of tension, hasn't there, between you and Ruth. And one, kind of the back in 2006, obviously there was the Sam, the herdman storyline.
Yes, don't mention his name, actually.
Well, I feel I have to for the sake of the podcast.
I know. I mean, the very name Sam. It was so great when she went off to New Zealand and the tour leader there, his name was Sam, and I was able to say it with all the hatred that I could possibly put into three letter word. Sam. That was very funny.
So there has been an ongoing tension between you, who's kind of born into farming, and Ruth, who went off to farming kind of college, didn't she? And and back in 2006, obviously, we had the Sam storyline. Sorry, I had to say that. And kind of at the end of it, one of the things that Ruth wanted to do was to become, basically to run the herd. And you're a little bit kind of sniffy about that. So, you know, can you remember much about that? But also, how was the dynamic between, you know, this husband and wife farming team being played out during your marriage, actually, on the show, do you think?
Well, it's been a long sort of drawn out acceptance from David's point of view of not to be, you know, kind of misogynistic about it and saying that there is a role for, you know, for women in farming. And that's that was done very much on purpose. That wasn't obviously me. That was the scriptwriters, and that was the what wanted to be done, because, of course, it is. And, you know, you look at husband and wife farmers around the world, and they are a team. And there is now, there's no difference between the two at all. Whereas before, I think it probably was more sort of male centrist, and David had to be educated about that, and has now accepted it, I think, completely. I mean, he really admires her farming ability and her ability to be able to do absolutely everything on the farm. I think they think of themselves, both of them, as a team. And that was very clear with the whole moving north story about when, you know, David made executive decisions on his own without consulting her. And she quite rightly got very pissed off about that and said, you know, I thought we were a team. And, you know, he, for his own reasons and his own slight kind of closing, you know, close onto a nervous breakdown, that whole thing about hearing his dad in his ears. I mean, I thought it was so well done, so well written. And so, yeah, I mean, in terms of at that point about her being the herd manager, yes, it was great drama to be able to see that David was resistant to that for a long time. But eventually he came round to it, and she's proved herself to be, you know, every bit as good as anybody else. The underlying kind of ramifications of her nearly having an affair with Sam, you know, have lingered on, which is what, again, is so extraordinary about this program, is that it's not a book, it's not a play, it's not something that is, you know, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It goes on and on and on. And so when she went off last year to New Zealand, and this worry about, you know, is she going to come back, and what is their marriage like? That was, you know, had the echoes of the Sam affair thing. That's bubbling. That's there. It never goes away. You know, in my mind, anyway. I don't know. I mean, it's not written, but in my mind, he's terrified because, you know, he adores her and he loves her and he doesn't want to lose her. And any kind of hint of the idea that that's not reciprocal scares the living daylights out of him.
Tim, who does he fear losing most, his mother or his wife?
His wife, because his mother's... Sure? You know, yeah, because his mum's old and she's going to die. He knows that. And also, his father has died. And, you know, people died. So generationally, he knows that his mother is going to die, and that he will have to cope with that, and he will. I think he's much, much more terrified about losing his wife, and, or, you know, even more so his children, which is the nature. It's the nature of things. You know, that's how everybody is, really, isn't it? Mm. We're all like that. I mean, you very cheekily introduced me as mummy's boy. I mean, there's David is mummy's boy, and I think
Sir,
I said I
feel I've been accurate, not cheeky.
He's got a very, very close relationship with his mother, and that, you know, that's written, you know, that's there in the writing. But it's also, and I've, you know, admitted to this, I'm enormously fond of Paddy, and I think I've said my mum died when I was 13, and so she has been, you know, I've been in the program 35 years, and she's been like a mother figure to me. So if that comes over, then I'm not, you know, I don't mind about that. That's okay. It's all right to love your mum.
absolutely. Now, kind of looking back at all these kind of old storylines, it does appear that we all know, number one, that Brookfield is actually the epicentre of the Archers as a dramatic construct. And then January the 1st is the birthday of the show. So, but looking back at all these storylines, you know, the script writers, past and present, have used January the 1st to look at the future of Brookfield, but all, and then have kind of seemed to mark it, obviously in 2000 very clearly, but then back in 2011 that was less about Brookfield but and more of getting rid of an Archers kind of fan favorite. So how important do you think, and we kind of touched on this before, but how important do you think marking the show's birthday actually is and should be, really? So let's talk about that and then go on to you getting away with murder back in 2011.
Do you mean about how marking particular kind of like 50th and 60th and things like that?
And also the fact that it's the show's birthday, because the one thing which I've realized a couple of weeks back, June Dumpty Dum, is that in terms of soaps, this is the only soap that absolutely does mark birthdays and wedding anniversaries every year. So you have an idea when Brian and Jennifer's wedding anniversary is. And, you know, when I was watching Corrie as a kid, I couldn't have told you when Stan and Hilda's wedding anniversary. You know, it is, you know, it absolutely does, you know, and, and it is the regularity of the panto. You know, Linda doing the panto is the panto because it's always the same thing every year. Yeah. Your wedding anniversary with Ruth is always mentioned, etc. And it's absolutely unique in that way. And I think, you know, this whole thing of January the 1st and the little focus, for the most part, being pushed back to Brookfield is definitely a recurrence and a nod and a wink to the birthday anniversary of the whole show.
Well, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. And obviously, I mean, there is a difference between the marking of the fictitious birthdays of the characters and the marking of the actual birthday of the programme, which obviously, you know, you can't say, oh, look, you know, we've been here for 60 years. but yeah, I mean, I don't know. As I say, I don't know whether or not that's conscious that it comes back to Brookfield for that moment. I think that, you know, from the publicity team's point of view, they're always going to mark, you know, the anniversaries of the program with a five and a naught in it, in order to kind of just to drum up, you know, attention. And as I say, to keep new listeners coming in, it's such an important thing. You can't sit back on your laurels with the Archers and just let it pootle along. You've got to bring in the new listener, and if that's done by using marking the anniversaries of the program, then that may well be it. In terms of what was known as SATTC, Shock Ambridge to the Core, which was a quote that Vanessa said that was going to be for the 60th, isn't it? And Nigel, yes, I mean, that was that it was very, very contentious. I mean, the thing about it is, I never heard anybody say that they were really pleased that he went. I've never heard anybody say that it was a great thing for the program. And, you know, from our point of view as actors, we were very, very sad to see Graham go. And, you know, also from my point of view as turning it around, when I'm the other side of the thing, speaker listening to it, I accept the fact that, you know, that his was a very, very idiosyncratic character. And you need those characters. You need those people who sound different. You need those characters who are different. Otherwise, you know, you never want to have that thing where you turn the radio on, you go in the Archers and you go, I don't know who's talking to each, you know, who that is. People need to have a voice which is clearly them. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know that somebody new listeners could listen to me and to Alistair,
the character of Alistair,
and yeah, you know, and various others with sort of RP accents and things, and that there is a kind of a, you know, you all know what I sound like, and of course I'm completely idiosyncratic, but a new listener might not be able to make those distinctions. And if you listen to Nigel Pargeter, there was no, you know, there was absolutely nobody who sounded anything like him. And those, you know, those characters are important, and also just as an archetype about what he represented, you know, the silly ass toff, you know, there's a place for that. So now you've got, you know, it's people like Justin Elliott, played by the, you know, completely idiosyncratically voiced Simon Williams, who we all know from Upstairs, Downstairs. Well, some of us might do. And he, you know, he's sort of, you know, he's a sort of, I guess, replacement for that kind of archetype. Mm. But yeah, pushing Nigel, as you know, I did, you know, he didn't just fall. He was pushed. In fact, I was talking to this lovely guy called John, who's one of our spot effects guys who works in who does the grams and things in the studio and comes in and does spot effects with us. He showed me a photograph of, because it was his tiles from his roof, mm-hmm, that they used as the sound effect for Nigel slipping. And he's framed it. He's got these tiles framed and with the title underneath it. These were the very tiles that Nigel slipped on when he fell to his doom. And you know the story about the elongated screen, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
it, half a mile high or something or another.
Yeah, because they extended it in post-production. And because we worked out when we were doing it, you know, how high is it? How long would the screen be? And he did it, you know, mm-hmm, it was quite short, because it wouldn't be, you know, you're in the air, bath.
Yeah.
And we did that, and then they felt it wasn't dramatic enough, and so they elongated it in post-production, and that was why it was a bit contentious. So we did our job right, but they over-dramatized it. Mm. But it did sound more dramatic like that.
No, it did. You raise an interesting point about the accents, and it's something which is kind of ongoing on social media, and I'm sure you've seen it, that a lot of the younger, newer characters do sound much more homogenous. But it kind of occurred to me, and I'm a kind of a map and history kind of geek, less so of a linguistics one, but we are actually losing regional accents. And, you know, this is just a fact of modern British life. And things like, ironically, the BBC... are helping to kind of to deaden those things. So in lots of ways, the younger characters being more interchangeable in terms of their accents is actually somewhat realistic to British life, wouldn't you think? You know, you listen back to those old recordings of the Archers, and it is something from another planet, literally, you know, kind of accent wise and I presume was much more reflective of rural Britain back then.
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, there are some accents which, you know, people, particularly city accents, which people stick to, which aren't going to go away anytime soon. I mean, you know, I was down in Bristol recently, and I mean, I was at drama school there and everything, and I got mates, you know, old John Telford down there, who plays the vicar. And you know, you go into a pub in Bristol, and that hasn't changed. You know, that's still, you know, very, very much a Bristolian accent, and it's not just Marmoset; it's Bristolian. It's different. And you know, you go down to the West Country, that's West Country down there. You go, you know, Scouse, that's not going to go away anytime soon. You know, Galician, it's not going to go away anytime soon either. You know, you got Jazzer, at least you got Jazzer there. Geordie isn't going to go away. You know, there are some regions where and Yorkshire, you know, on the other hand, at the moment, you know, I'm in Norfolk at the moment, and that old Norfolk accent, that certainly is going. You know, the younger generation, they don't talk like that. They ain't got that whole Norfolk thing. It's not. It's much more kind of Londonized. It's a kind of a creeping estuarine English, which is coming up, you know, through Essex, through Suffolk, into Norfolk and things. And the younger generation, you're still there a bit, but a lot of it's going. And I think perhaps it's those milder accents that are just being muted. You know, they're not as strong, particularly. And they're not. The other thing is that dialect is dying out. You know, that where you'd have not just the accent, but all the words would be different. And that every, you know, you go. I mean, I remember when I was in Bristol, the next door neighbour, I would go into the pub and you'd listen to them. You couldn't understand them because they weren't using English words. They were using Bristolian dialect, you know. Mm. I think that's the kind of thing that's being homogenised by television. Same thing in America. You know, you look at those old accents, fascinating fishing communities up in Nantucket and in the Northeast, those islands up there, where they were so isolated for such a long time that 100 years ago, those accents on those fishing communities were Devon. They were Devon accents.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've been homogenised by television, you know, completely. And
that's absolutely kind of spot on. About 10 years ago or so, met someone from Nova Scotia. Right. No, not from Nova Scotia, Newfoundland in Canada.
Yeah.
And I just said to her, so where an island are you from? And, you know, and she gave me that kind of world-weary look. And she says, yes, that's what everybody thinks. I'm from Newfoundland. And it's like, and you look back at the history of that isolated bit of Canada and they were all Irish fishermen. And they just sound so Irish. It's absolutely, absolutely incredible. You know,
I have to say it's a pet subject of mine. It absolutely fascinates me, and one of my intentions this year is to work up a pitch to do to the BBC to do a TV program to front the TV program about the nature of the English accent and how it muted and it changed, and to look at the difference between the North and the South and where that comes from historically about the invasion of the Danes and the Anglo-Saxons and whether or not, you know, the Wessex and Anglo-Saxon and that North-South divide with the Dane law. Is reflected in modern North-South divide in the accents. And then to look at, you know, the American accent and how it changed and where that old thing come from, you know, down south, where on earth, you know. Because I've read a lot about it, but it's never satisfactorily explained. Also, I've got a theory about Australian, which is closer to Norfolk than it is to English. And what I want to do is to get some professor of linguistics who really knows the subject and then me to go and interview people and get them to talk, and then for me to be able to, you know, because that's my job is accents, you know, that's what I do.
Well,
is to listen and hear and then try and reflect what it is and to work out, you know, where these historical movements came from. I think it'd be really interesting.
Well, listen, you've got one listener there, and if the BBC don't say yes to you, just come back to me. We'll do a podcast. There is an amazing podcast called The History of English, which isn't about accents, but it's just about the history of the development of the English language. Done by an American. It's very, very, very good.
Tim.
So give that a listen. He's up to, he's just got to Middle English.
Oh, good.
And what's brilliant about that is just hearing and just how, you know, language obviously goes round and round. So the Norman Conquest, and you've got all these all these French words that come in through the Norman invasion. But actually how some words, and don't ask what these words are, actually were Norse words which went into Norman French. We then got mangled, then come back into English, then sit alongside the original Norse words themselves. So it's absolutely fascinating. But give the history of English a little bit of a listen. Ideal for a commute when you're travelling up from Norfolk to Birmingham on the train to do the Arches, sir.
Excellent. I will do that. Is that that's on iPlayer, is it?
Yeah, well, no, not on iTunes.
On iTunes, English. Okay. All right, fantastic. I will check that out.
Now, you're kind of increasingly popping up, talking about on iPlayer. You have been on my iPlayer. Now, I was watching Tim Roth being all kind of dastardly and evil. And there you were on Ridlington Place.
Dr. Odette.
Oh, you got a terrible bedside manner.
I know. It was great with Samantha Morton. We had this one day in Glasgow where I had literally had one scene with her, and then she went out, and the next thing in comes Tim again, which was so weird because I was going to be calling it the Year of the Roth, because I did a film where I had a lead with his son Jack Roth thing called Us and Them, which is coming out at the moment. And then the very next job I got was this thing Reg, about this guy Reg Keyes, who was a true character, who took on Tony Blair at Sedgefield and the general election because his son had been killed in Iraq, and he thought he went out on a lie. And I played Frederick Forsyth, who was out on the campaign trail with him. And then the very next job I got was Rillington Place, and Tim Roth walks in and he said to me, "Are you stalking me?" I said to him, "No, mate." I said, "Just every single every single production from now on you're going to be in, you're going to have me in it, you know, as your lucky charm, because you might end up working with Tarantino if I work that way." But no, it was great. Yes, he was Dr. Odette was rather down on poor old Mrs. Christie. But yeah, no. And have you seen Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them?
I haven't yet.
Because you know, I start that. I pretty much open that movie. Have you seen? You know that?
Well, from what I heard, I read the reviews, and they said without you, the central point, the central premise of the whole thing just falls to pieces.
Absolutely right. It's completely, because I didn't realize, because they don't send you the script. You know, all I had was my side, so I knew nothing about the film at all. Mm-hmm. And my lines are opening this thing up, this blitzed building, and saying, you know, was like a wind, or like a ghost with bright shining eyes. And a dove down there, down on the ground. And at that moment, the wall cracks and the whole kind of pavement cracks up and everything. And then the whole film is all about this wind with bright shining eyes. So I was basically, I had no idea that I'd kind of introduced the main character of the film. It was really funny. And right at the end, in comes old, Jack Sparrow, who comes in right at the end, who's got fewer lines than I have. But you can be sure, I've worked it out, he's probably on 12,000 times the amount of money that I was.
But you know what, though, right? You kind of, in a way, you want to have what he has, but you don't to a certain degree as well, because he is one of the most overpaid actors in Hollywood in terms of box office receipts. So he's actually overpaid.
Yeah, I saw that. It's the amount you pay to the amount of box office receipt. Yeah, he's not worth the money. No, you get me, you see, and it's the complete opposite. You make millions and millions because you only have to pay me a few grand. You know, that's it. I tell you, I finally did crack up a part. I've been going up to some nice stuff. I managed to go up three times for The Crown, which, considering I'm a bit posh. The fact that I didn't get them, I was pretty pissed off. Mind you, I've been watching it just recently, and it is terrific. And it luckily, all the parts that I was up for have gone to very short, very fat, very old people. So I've gone, that's fine, that's okay, I wouldn't have got it. But I have got a part, I'm off to South Africa next month, just for a week. I've got a nice part in a new BBC series called The Last Post, which is all about Aden in the 1920s. And I'm going to be the brigadier in charge of a court-martial that goes on for an entire episode. So, yeah, I've got a week in South Africa. And it's great because I've never been to South Africa. So that would be
nice.
That's a nice start to the year.
Which bits of the empire haven't you been to that you'd like to go to? Because I know you're brought up in Australia, so you got that kind of covered. India? Done India?
I haven't done India. My sister went and did India. She, extraordinarily, aged 73, went backpacking in India on a kind of complete shoestring. So she's been giving me chapter and verse about that. And I'm not terribly good in the incredible heat, and it is so hot there. I think I'd have to go in the off season. I'm slightly more drawn to Canada, actually. I like the mountains and the snow. I've been to Canada once when I had this job driving tourists around America, and went and drove twice round working for a company called Trek America when I was in my 20s. And I went to Canada a bit there. But I'd love to go there just because of the beauty of the countryside. And the old Canucks are, you know, that is kind of like America light, isn't it? You know,
absolutely.
They're a bit more you know, the weird thing about if you'd want to do a Scottish a Canadian accent is all you do then is you do American and then you put Scots on the top of it, which is where you get that aboot thing, you know, the Canadians have always a giveaway when they say, well, going aboot here.
Yeah.
And that's completely from Scottish. Interestingly, that's when I was doing Fantastic Beasts and I had to go and work with this voice coach, which I'd never done before. Mm-hmm. We spent my whole life doing voices. And she said, yeah, so it's Brooklyn. I went, yeah, so it's kind of basically it's Dutch, isn't it? She said, what? I said, because Manhattan used to belong to Holland. It was Dutch. Mm. And then the English came in. And so, you know, you got to, so basically what you do is you have to think of the Dutch accent and then you put that on top of American accent. And so you go to America, Dutch on top of American, and then it turns into to New Jersey. It turns into Brooklyn. And then you get that whole thing, Toity Toity Street. And that's where that whole thing comes from. And she looked at me and she said, really? I went, yeah, that's what I think. She said, this is a top voice coach, and she didn't know. But it's things like that fascinate me, you know, when you amalgamate two accents, you put them together and you come up with a third one, like in Canada. Great stuff. Love it.
I'm going to ping you a link when I can actually find it. Another thing which kind of blew my mind, it's not linguistics, but you talked about the Danelaw and how that's affected kind of accents in the north and the east of England. Mm. And I remember the classic thing which I always learnt from school is place names with a BY on the end, your Darby's and your Tembys are all Norse founded towns, and you can see the line of them that go up the old kind of Inkneil's Way, the old Roman road, and because the Danelaw was to the east and Anglo-Saxon England was to the west.
Right.
So, but a map which blew me away is and we're really getting off of the Archers here. But
we,
you know
we
what?
Are,
it's my podcast and we're having a chat and I can do whatever I want. absolutely blew my mind. I said, I will find this link. I'll post it on our Dumdy Dum Twitter feed as well. It is the preponderance of blonde hair in Europe. Okay. And it maps it. My God, Mr. Bentinck, does that thing show you historical movements? So you see the Danelaw, you wouldn't have thought that, you know, some, what, 1,300 years after the Viking invasions, that the preponderance of blonde hair maps the Danelaw. It absolutely does. You can see the Norse invasion of northern France, i.e. Normandy. You can see the old Moscovoy principality in Russia, because that was founded by Vikings also. You can see the boundaries of the Roman Empire, because on the other side of it, there's much more blonde hair. Mm. And then, of course, you know, in France, in Italy, etc., then the preponderance of blonde hair falls dramatically. It's the most fascinating thing, and I will send it to you. And there is something to be, you know, so this whole thing about linguistics and actually the patterns of migration and actually the echoes of that aren't just with accents and with words and with language, but also you know, to do with you know, genomes and ethnotypes. It's absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Completely up my street, mate. Thank you very much indeed. I really look forward to seeing that. That's great.
Well, and on that note, sir, I wish you a happy 2017. Sorry. 17. It seems that for you, you know, you've got more and more acting work. So that's a good thing.
Well, you know, time needs must. I mean, the fact that there was a bit of a drop off on the Archers meant, you know, I had a word with the agent and I said, you know, let's go. In fact, the person I'm having lunch with in 10 minutes is my agent, so we'll be chatting about that. But she's been great because I've only been with her for a couple of years and it's picking up. And, you know, that's the nature of the beast. I'm an actor and, you know, lovely as the Archers is and fantastic and honoured as I am to be in it. You know, one does want to stretch one's wings as an actor, and you do want to have interesting parts and do, you know, do different things. So you know, bring it on. And I'm finishing off my autobiography. In fact, I think I've come to the end of it. I've done 103,000 words now, so that's going to go off to the publisher, and the deadline's March. So it will be out in Christmas 2017. It's going to be called Being David Archer, and then underneath it, and other unusual ways of earning a living. So it's got a huge Archer section. And then the rest, you know, are sort of funny things that have happened over my life. So it's been a real extraordinary exploration, kind of going back on one's life. It's a weird thing to do, writing, you know, the history of your life. It brings back a lot of memories, and you're turning over stones that have been kept, you know, closed, and you're opening things up. It's quite cathartic, actually.
I'll be thumbing through that to see references to the kind of insightful interviews that, you know, I've put you through.
Glad you're right. Mr. B. Absolutely spot on. In fact, I shall go downstairs now and write that in.
I recommend you do.
Can I have this opportunity of saying to all the listeners to say a really, really happy new year to you, all of you. And I hope you had a great Christmas, and I hope you've been enjoying the Archers. And, you know, it's never going to get boring. It's never going to get dull. There'll always be something for you to shout at. And I hope you've had some nice, interesting, you know, digital radios for Christmas that you can shout at them in perfect clarity. and enjoy it. And thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for coming on. But we're just going to do a little bit of shopkeeping now, and then you can quickly give us your Twitter handle, and I say something like this: dumdydum.com. Well, folks, it's been down recently because of those pesky Azerbaijanis and their Russian cousins. However, the site, by the time this podcast goes up, should be back up, and there will be news on the new direction that the show's going to have to take if we're going to be serious and grown up about things in 2017. But there'll be news on that in a future podcast. So dumdydum.com, go there. It's got a shop. You can buy things. There's a forum. You can do stuff. It's awesome. iTunes reviews. We haven't had any for ages. Please send them in, because we want to be top of those podcasting charts. And actually, we are in what's hot for TV and media in iTunes, but we want to get to the top of all the charts, not just the what's hot section. So please write us an iTunes review if you haven't done so already. Now, folks, there's going to be a big fundraising drive in 2017 because we can't have this site keep on going down because it's been hacked. But you can help us by donating to us. And there's a couple of ways this can be done. You can do it by going onto the site when it's back up and hitting that donate button. Or you can go to patreon.com and you can donate $2 a show. It has to be in dollars because it's an American website, but they convert it to pounds and all sorts. And then it goes to pay our server and hosts and all that kind of malarkey. So patreon.com or hit that donate button. Remember, folks, there's a few ways you can get in contact with us. You can send us a voice message via SpeakPipe on our website. Simply hit that little red button. Or if that befuddles you, you can go to 0203-0313-105 to leave us a telephonic message from your own phone, if the website doesn't work for you. And we need your voices on our regular show, so please go and do that. On social media, you can find us where we are at dumdydum. Me, I'm at Royfield, spelled R-O-I for India, F-I-E-L-D. Harriet, the voices of 1,000 Archers women. You can find her at Sambridges. Lucy's at Lucy V. Freeman. And Mr. B, how can people find you on the Twitters?
I'm at Tim Bentinck, all one word, T-I-M-B-E-N-T-I-N-C-K.
That's a bit of an interesting surname, though. We've never really properly drilled into your surname, but it's Dutch, isn't it?
Well, it is Dutch. And funnily enough, just a couple of months ago, me and Judy and Will, my son, went over to Holland for a day-long symposium on the world of the Bentincks, which was attended by all these academics from Holland and Germany and France and England. And I sat there listening to these extraordinary analysis of my direct ancestors. Yeah, we're Dutch, but came over with William of Orange for the Glorious Revolution. My ancestor Hans Willem Bentinck was the close right-hand man of William of Orange, and without Bentinck, it wouldn't have happened, and the whole of European history would have been different. So he was a very important man. But my branch of the family has been sort of mostly English, sort of Anglo-Dutch, ever since that then. That was 1689. So yeah, we're you know. We're English, you know. I passed the cricket test. You know, most of my ancestors were in the army or in the navy, so we've done our bit.
Well, just to do a bit of a boring history segue, as is my want on my own podcast, but I've always been kind of fascinated by those kind of historical echoes, and the Royal Dutch House of Orange has always been fascinating for me, because originally from Orange in France, then they become the state holders in Holland. It's the House of Holland. And then it's Dutch migrants that then go to South Africa, and hence you have the Orange Free State. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have Orangemen in Northern Ireland, who's another echo of exactly that kind of, that ran about the time of the Glorious Revolution. And it's Protestants being associated with the colour orange. And then, of course, on the Irish tricolour, you have orange as a symbol of the Protestant bit of Ireland, and green bit on the tricolour is to, you know, denote the Catholics. But I could bore on forever about this type of stuff, Mr. B. And on that note,
if you want some more information on the family thing, my website, which I'm having, it's got so much on it, I keep meaning to update it to be a responsive one. And I do other people's, but mine is still old-fashioned. But it's all there. It's www.bentinck.net, BENTINCK.net. So have a look at that and go to family section and you can read all about it.
Fab. We'll do this again sometime soon. Have a great, wonderful, smashing, super 2017. And go meet your agent.
Thank you very much. Bye, everybody.
Bye bye, mate. Brilliant. Bye bye. Thanks, Tim.
Being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.